can train with them in Alaska like we can train very few other places in the world. The range airspace there is phenomenal.
An update on the Air Force's F-35 plan in Alaska as Obama hopes to slow the pace of the program. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, February 11th. Good evening. I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, researchers detect biotoxic marine mammals for the first time.
These are animals that are integral to the culture and the community and food security here in Alaska.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
The Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence.
And by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on Condor.com. Condor, born to fly.
President Obama's 2017 Air Force budget would slow the pace of buying F-35s. That's the new fighter jet slated for Eielson Air Force Base, but top Air Force officials still speak highly of the plan to station them at the Fairbanks base. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
Massive cost overruns and delays have dogged the F-35, but the Pentagon insists those problems are now under control. So it was unfortunate optics that the general in charge of the Air Force budget, James Martin, fainted forehead to podium during a press briefing this week, just as he and his budget deputy, Carolyn Gleason, were answering questions about the F-35. Gleason grabbed the general by the arm and hardly missed a beat.
What happened?
Goodness, it's okay, you're all right.
Sure,
okay,
yeah.
That's what the F-35 will do to you.
Sorry.
Martin, before the episode, said spending constraints require the Air Force to buy fewer F-35s over the next 5 years to save nearly $5 billion. Next year's Air Force budget calls for 43 of the aircraft instead of the 48 planned. The Air Force chose Eielson as the first base in the Pacific for the F-35, pending environmental review. The aircraft are due to arrive in 2019. Air Force Chief of Staff Mark Welsh sounded upbeat when he gave a progress report on Capitol Hill Wednesday at the request of Senator Lisa Murkowski.
This isn't a PowerPoint program anymore. About a year from now, we will have 100 F-35s in our Air Force inventory. We've already flown 45,000 hours on this airplane.
Welsh says deferring the purchase of some F-35s will not affect the basing process.
And I'm very excited about getting the airplane to Alaska for two reasons. Partners in the Pacific want to buy the F-35. We can train with them in Alaska like we can train very few other places in the world. The range airspace there is phenomenal. And that location, as we've talked before, geography does matter.
The Air Force is still struggling to find maintenance manpower for the F-35 without adding personnel. They've been using contractors, but Welsh says they'll need crews capable of deploying.
As we get closer to full operational capability of this aircraft and we have more squadrons fielding, we need to get at active duty Air Force maintainers and have them available to stand up operational bases like Eielson.
Murkowski says the budget also includes nearly $300 million for Eielson, including seven projects to support the F-35. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Scientists have documented two biotoxins in Alaska's marine mammal population above the Arctic Circle for the first time. That's according to a new study out today in the journal Harmful Algae. But as KNOM's Emily Schwing reports, it's not clear if algal toxins have always existed in the Arctic because scientists haven't looked for them before.
Scientists didn't expect to find algal toxins in ocean water or marine mammals that range north of the Gulf of Alaska or the state's southeast region.
This is really important because these are animals that are integral to the culture and the community and food security here in Alaska.
Dr. Frances Gulland is a commissioner with the Federal Marine Mammal Commission. She also co-authored the new study.
There are detectable levels that have actually been measured of two different biotoxins, domoic acid and saxitoxin. And both these are toxins produced by harmful algal blooms.
The two are known to cause amnesic shellfish disorder and paralytic shellfish disorder in people. Gay Sheffield is a biologist with the Alaska Sea Grant's Marine Advisory Program. She's also a study co-author.
Now that we see that algae is there, what would be the best course of action to make it comprehensive knowledge is to find out how our Russian neighbors have seen any of these unusual algaes or unusual, you know, if they have any unusual concerns. And more importantly, is there a traditional knowledge on shellfish poisoning or algal blooms or strange behavioral events with marine mammals?
After algae die in the ocean, what's left gets consumed or filtered by shellfish like clams and mussels, staple foods for many marine mammals. So if there are algal toxins present, they could end up in the gut contents of an unsuspecting Pacific walrus, for example. Sheffield says of the 13 marine mammal species sampled over the course of nearly a decade, walrus had the highest levels of algal toxins.
And because it's such an important subsistence food item for the Bering Strait, there's of course interest both from an animal health perspective, but a public health, human health, food security as well. But right now, there's no problem.
According to the study, levels of algal toxins measured don't exceed regulatory limits for seafood safety in Alaska or at the federal level. It's also not clear if the toxins have always been present in the far north, because scientists never tested for them before now. Frances Gulland adds that the study isn't only limited in size, but the data itself can't provide information about the magnitude of exposure, because toxins like domoic acid are cleared from an animal's bloodstream or its gastrointestinal system so quickly.
So if you think about if the animal ate some food 10 minutes ago that was full of domoic acid, it would have a high level. But if it's 12 hours since the animal ate, the levels will be lower. If it was 2 days since the animal ate, they may be really low. So really, the data are limited because they're only telling you what's there at that snapshot in time.
Research does indicate an increase in the occurrence of algal blooms in the Arctic. Gulland believes that's due to warming ocean temperatures and changes in sea ice extent.
The plants, they grow, they are temperature dependent, so clearly with warmer waters, they're going to replicate quicker. So it's sensible to assume that temperature is important. But there are also changes in micronutrients, things like iron and different components of water that will affect how they bloom as well.
Funding for study sampling came from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the National Marine Fisheries Service, and the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Additional money came from the National Institute of Health and the National Science Foundation. I'm Emily Schwing in Nome.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Yukon Quest mushers and dogs take a much-needed break in Dawson City.
A little cozier, like they have a big tarp over them and kind of tried to block off all the wind, so it's nice and warm in there for them.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Artists make us think and question. They excite and engage. Artists inspire Alaska. The 2016 Rasmussen Foundation Individual Artist Awards Grant Program is now accepting applications. Individual Artist Awards support Alaska artists in 10 creative disciplines at all career stages. The program is open to Alaska residents only. For details and to apply, visit rasmussen.org/IAA. The deadline is March 1st, 2016. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
The focus of most Alaska lawmakers in the first 3 weeks of the legislative session has been on cutting the state's budget. But Anchorage Democratic Representative Les Guerra wants to make sure that these cuts don't fall too heavily on working class and low-income people. Guerra has instead proposed a bill that would apply a 6% tax on the owners of businesses that aren't currently taxed by the state. These businesses are called S-corporations, and their owners report the business income as personal income.
Most corporations in the state pay no tax whatsoever. They pay a $100 license fee, even if they make $10 million a year in profits. That doesn't make sense.
Governor Bill Walker's proposed budget would affect these business owners. That's because they would be required to pay a personal income tax of between 1 and 2%. Guerra says that rate isn't high enough.
That doesn't work. I mean, the corporate tax is 9.4%. 2% is almost nothing for a corporation that makes over $200,000 a year or over $1 million a year or over $5 million a year.
House Speaker Mike Chenault, a Nikiski Republican, agrees the legislature could consider taxing S corporations, but he adds that the burden of state taxation has rested on certain businesses, especially the oil industry, for more than 35 years. Anchorage Republican Representative Lance Pruitt says most legislators want to focus their efforts on finding savings in government spending. Finance subcommittees have been analyzing each section of the budget.
That's the difference in philosophy. I think Rep. Guerra believes that we can tax our way out of this, and we can't tax our way out of this. That's why it's so important, the job that the subcommittees are doing right now.
Guerra says even if his particular bill isn't enacted, he hopes that the idea of taxing S corporations becomes a part of the budget, even if a different legislator sponsors it. For 40 years, Alaska's North Slope oil production has taken place on a stretch of state land sandwiched between two major federal reserves. To the east is the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge. To the west, the much larger National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska, which, despite its name, never produced any oil until this fall. ConocoPhillips hopes to change that in a big way. Despite oil prices hovering around $30 per barrel, the company is plowing ahead with efforts to develop the NPRA. The company invited Alaska journalists on a tour this week of CD5, its newest drill site. And then the company hopes the gateway to more development. From the Energy Desk, APRN's Rachel Waldholtz tagged along and sent this report.
The 7 a.m. flight to the Kuparuk oil field took off from Anchorage with a dozen reporters joining the regular commuting crowd.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Once again, welcome aboard Shared Services Flight 151 with service to Kuparuk.
This is the only way to reach Kuparuk, on a plane operated by ConocoPhillips and BP's Shared Services, which ferries more than 26,000 workers a month to and from the North Slope fields. When we land, it's a balmy negative 7 degrees. Taking in the modular buildings, heavy equipment, and steam rising in the distance, one reporter commented that this must be what it will look like when we colonize other planets. Kuparuk can house up to 2,500 people. Operations manager Ty Maxey says keeping them all fed, safe, and comfortable is an operation in and of itself.
We're like a little city, and we have our own power system, our own wastewater treatment system, our own potable water treatment system for basically a small-sized city.
Alaska's most famous field is Prudhoe Bay. Discovered in 1968, it's still the largest oil field in North America. It's operated by BP. Conoco's Kuparuk River Unit is 40 miles west of Prudhoe and only slightly less massive. It began operations in 1981. West of Kuparuk is Alpine. That's where we're headed now, rolling across the tundra in a noisy tour bus. Alpine came online in 2000. If Kuparuk can house 2,500 people, Alpine has about 450 right now.
Is there a rivalry? Is there like Kuparuk-Alpine softball games?
No, well, there's a bit of a rivalry.
Steve Thatcher is the operations manager at Alpine.
You know, Kuparuk is the big brother for Alpine, that's for sure. It's much bigger, much more complicated field. But Alpine's where we're growing, we're getting bigger. It's a nice place to work. It's a nice size field, not too big.
The newest development is CD5. The drill site is on a tentacle of road stretching west from Alpine and sits just inside the National Petroleum Reserve. The billion-dollar project started producing oil in October and is eventually expected to produce about 16,000 barrels per day. CD5 is both the gateway and the launch pad for development in the rest of the NPRA. From there, Conoco plans to build a road to its next development, Greater Moose's Tooth 1. And from there, if it gets through permitting, to Greater Moose's Tooth 2. So today, we're traveling west. If you remember just one thing, that's it. This is what Conoco is doing on the North Slope, marching west.
Yeah, so this is drill site 2L, and this is the beginning of the ice road. So we're essentially on ice from this point until we arrive at the Alpine facility.
That's Jim Brody, Conoco's project manager for CD5 and the NPRA. There's no permanent road connecting Alpine and Kuparuk. Instead, during the winter, the two units are linked by a 25-mile ice road. Built with ice chips harvested from lakes along the route, the ice road is rebuilt every winter at a cost of $20 million each time. In the summer, it melts into the tundra, leaving Alpine accessible only by plane. Roads, their presence or absence, are a big deal on the North Slope, and often one of the hardest things to get regulators to approve. It took 10 years to permit CD5, in no small part because the project required a 6-mile gravel road and 4 bridges, including this one, over the Nicklick Channel. At 1,400 feet, it's the largest bridge on the North Slope. And, Brody says, it has another significance.
On the other side of this bridge, we will be in NPRA. This defines the boundary of NPRA.
It also happens to cross a key subsistence fishing area for the village of Nuiqsut, which is just 8 miles from Alpine. Though it's inside the NPRA, CD5 is actually on land owned by the Nuiqsut Village Corporation, CUPIC. The road was controversial, and the village insisted Conoco change the bridge location. Isaac Nukapiak is CUPIC's president.
In the beginning, we had a little disagreement of where, how the project itself should be developed. So we were managed, we're able to manage to compromise in way of responsible development, okay, balance.
As for development further west in NPRA, Nukapiak's view is it's going to happen one way or another, and Nuiqsut needs to have a seat at the table. Finally, we arrive at CD5 itself. As we drive up, a Doyon drill rig emerges from the fog, sitting crouched on the pad like a rocket, not far from some caribou. Ever wonder what a drill rig sounds like? Well, you are in luck. It's at work on an injection well. And that's it, the sound of the activity that for some 40 years has driven Alaska's fate. The newest well on the North Slope is underway. From the Energy Desk, I'm Rachel Waltholz in Anchorage.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Full Circle, delivering organic produce and artisan groceries, including Alaskan products, across Alaska. Learn about year-round delivery options at fullcircle.com/APRN. Alaska Pacific University delivers a distinctive educational adventure designed to support your personal and professional goals. Through generous APU scholarship packages and the new APU Promise Tuition Grant Program, APU is a sound educational investment in your future. Apply today at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
An agreement between the state and the Matanuska Susitna Borough is soon to be finalized regarding state land the borough wants for a railroad right-of-way. The borough had purchased several agricultural parcels from the state in the Point McKenzie area for a right-of-way for the rail spur between Port McKenzie and Houston, but agricultural covenants on the land didn't allow industrial use. The borough sued to have the covenants removed, according to State Attorney Bob McFarlane. McFarlane says removing the agricultural covenants is a precedent in Alaska.
The agricultural covenants that we've agreed to remove, or that we're removing in this case, is only for the portion of the parcels. There's 10 parcels involved. It's only for the portion that will be used by the railroad.
The railroad right-of-way will be on land previously authorized by the Federal Surface Transportation Board. McFarlane hopes to have the purchase wrapped up by April. The past 3 weeks have been turbulent at the Mount Edgecombe High School in Sitka. The Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, or ANSEP, has proposed turning the 70-year-old boarding school into an accelerated high school with an emphasis on science and engineering. It all began when ANSEP founder Herb Schroeder presented his idea to lawmakers in January as a draft piece of legislation. Since then, the University of Alaska has clarified that they haven't endorsed the proposal. Now, Edgecombe students and teachers are asking questions about ANSEP's motivations and whether the plan would even work. KCAW's Emily Kwong has more.
Erica Willis and Sochi Martinez are in Mount Edgecombe's radio club. They broadcast every other week.
Okay, so the past week or two, I have left our school in a bit of a tizzy due to a situation that's come up.
And for anyone listening to their program, you can tell these two students are not pleased.
Though our school and ANSEP have had good relations and a strong partnership in the past, this was brought before the legislature without consulting any of the people who actually run Edgecombe.
Nor did ANSEP secure the approval of the Department of Education and Early Development, the Board of Regents, or the University of Alaska, who would absorb any retained Edgecombe staff should the plan roll through. Speaking with KCAW after she got off air, Martinez says she's confused as to why Schroeder, ANSEP's founder, wanted to take over instead of collaborate.
Why didn't he come talk to Edgecombe about, like, inputting more STEM classes or integrating a program that would fast-track kids through 3 years, but at the same time they could keep the old program? I don't see why that couldn't work and why he would just decide to go straight to legislature. Like, dude.
Historically, the institutions have been friendly, if casual, partners. ANSEP has trained Edgecombe teachers. Edgecombe kids have flown up to Anchorage to take part in ANSEP summer programs. Martinez says one of her friends still has a desktop computer ANSEP gave her. The Gustavus-born senior was living in Oregon when she decided to apply to Edgecombe. And she says that while an ANSEP boarding school sounds appealing, it wouldn't have been a good match for her.
I don't have the scores for something that would be fast-tracked. I'm not good at classes that are going to be sped up or anything. So I'd be concerned about my own education and stuff and probably would have stayed in Oregon.
In a press release issued last week, ANSEP stated that students at its school would earn dozens of credits toward a bachelor's degree of engineering, science, psychology, or education, and graduate college in 3 years. For Willis, also a senior, her big bone to pick is that ANSEP feeds the University of Alaska only.
I have applied to UAF just in case, but it's not my first choice. I'd rather go to school out of state.
Willis is from Central, a tiny community near Fairbanks. She considers ANSEP a fantastic program for rural Alaskans like herself. But she was adamant that if ANSEP wants to fix education in the state, they're better off leaving Edgecombe alone and putting their energies towards other problems.
There's other proposals going through legislature to raise the number of minimum students to keep a school open. So in the next few years, there's a really good possibility that there's going to be a lot more schools closing. So there's going to be that many more kids without schools to attend. And then if they don't have as many options for other places to go, then I don't know, I can't predict the future, but that doesn't seem like it's a great combination of factors.
Teacher Dionne Brady Howard worries about this, too.
The fact is, a four-year to a three-year program and a narrower focus means things will be lost.
If Edgecombe had a pride parade, Brady Howard would be marching in front, probably with a cardinal and gold baton. She graduated in 1991, has taught social studies since 2000, and sent both her daughters through the school. And she's worried that young Alaskans wouldn't be ready to sign on to the kind of school ANSEP has in mind by the eighth grade. In their press release, ANSEP further claims that it will have all its graduates career ready by age 20.
There are so many of us who go out into the world and can barely declare a major by the time we're 20, let alone know that we're already certified as an engineer or a scientist and be work ready. And so to expect 13-year-olds applying to the ANSEP Mount Edgecombe Accelerated High School that they're proposing is a bit daunting.
Though very little is on paper, after all, no bill has been filed to further ANSEP's proposal, Martinez says that ANSEP has kind of come to represent a boogeyman for Edgecombe students, if not a running punchline.
Something breaks, oh, it's ANSEP's fault. Something happens, oh, it's ANSEP. This is totally a conspiracy by ANSEP. A bunch of running jokes. I think that's how Edgecombe deals with things. Really bad humor.
Bad humor, maybe. And a lot of Edgecombe pride, for sure. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Kwong.
The top Yukon Quest teams are in Dawson City, Yukon, settled in for a mandatory 36-hour layover at the race's halfway point. Brent Sass was first into Dawson yesterday. He's eligible to leave around midnight. Sass will be followed out by Alan Moore, who trailed him into Dawson by 2 hours, and Hugh Neff, who's another 30 minutes back in third place. Dawson provides Quest teams a much-needed break, and as KUAC's Molly Reddig reports, that goes for dogs and mushers.
Michelle Phillips cheered on her husband and their dogs as they ran into Dawson City on top of light, airy snow. Ed Hopkins was smiling inside the crowded finish chute on Front Street. He said it was good to be back in Canada. He had just finished a 90-mile run that had been rerouted from the Yukon River onto the Taylor Highway, a summer-only road.
Oh, shoot, it's like a sprint track out there.
Hopkins was fifth into Dawson. After running 90 miles straight, he was feeling the distance.
Oh, I'm tired. I'm just tired. I don't know. Yeah, I'm just tired. I just can't really seem to find that other gear.
He said his dogs had more energy, though.
But these guys are doing good. I mean, they're making me look good, but actually, it's a lot of work looking after these guys, though, you know?
Roughly 500 miles from Fairbanks, Dawson City is the halfway point of the Yukon Quest. The grid of colorful buildings is tucked between the Yukon River and rows of snow-covered mountains.
it still feels like the gold rush here, with clapboard buildings and historic saloons connected by wooden sidewalks. An old sternwheeler rests on the banks of the river just down from the race chute.
Dawson is here because of the gold rush, the discovery of gold in 1896.
Gabby Skaga has overseen the checkpoint in Dawson for 10 years, and she also happens to be a history buff. When the nugget was found a century ago, it set off a furious stampede to the Yukon goldfields. The town is still fixated on gold today, but it also loves dog mushing. In fact, the Yukon flag even has a husky on it. Skaga says dogs helped settle the frontier town.
Everything was done by dogs, delivery of water, transportation, everything, because no one thought horses could survive.
Horses eventually took over in town, but dogs still dominated the backcountry for a long time.
Going to the outlying areas out on the river, up over the hills, trading routes, the First Nations, dogs were really the easiest and best way to get around.
Dawson is the first stop on the Yukon quest where mushers are allowed to receive outside help. After 4 days of camping in the snow, eating food from a bag, and talking almost exclusively to dogs, mushers finally get a break in Dawson.
If they want, they get to have a shower, they get to have a beer, they get to have some food, they get to talk to people. This is a time that they could maybe become human again for a little while.
As Hopkins mushed toward the chute, two people were busy prepping for his arrival.
That's the mini fish.
Well, we got the mini fish, and then we got the bag of beer and wine and orange
and good stuff.
Trina Manak is one of his dog handlers. Along with Hopkins' wife, she spent almost 4 hours putting the camp together.
So we put the Arctic tent up, and then we put the stove up, we put the dog tent up, placed all the straw for the dogs so it's nice and cozy when they get there. And just now we just soak some treats for them so when they get here they can have a nice little fish snack.
Then they soak meat, feed the dogs dinner, and put them to bed. Like mushers, dogs also get a few perks in Dawson that aren't available at other checkpoints.
A little cozier, like they have a big tarp over them and kind of tried to block off all the wind, so it's nice and warm in there for them.
Hopkins left the excitement of French Street for the campground across the river, with a day and a half to rest before running another 500 miles.
I mean, we're just barely over halfway, really, right? So anything can happen.
On the Yukon Quest Trail in Dawson, I'm Molly Redig.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Emily Schwing in Nome, Rachel Waldholtz on the North Slope, Emily Kwong in Sitka, and Molly Redig on the Yukon Quest Trail. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Ron Zastro. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. Full Circle, delivering organic produce and groceries across Alaska since 2006, featuring fresh pasta, coffee, fish, and baked items from Alaskan producers. More at fullcircle.com/APRN.
And by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
It's as easy as 1, 2, 3. 1, file your 2016 PFD application today. 2, receive a confirmation of filing. And 3, sign electronically with your secure My Alaska account. Visit pfd.alaska.gov for more information. And remember, the deadline to apply is Thursday, March 31st. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.